Into the Fold is a podcast on mental health issues, produced by the Haug Foundation for Mental Health. The Haug Foundation is a strategic grant maker based at the University of Texas at Austin. To learn more, visit us at hogg.utexas.edu. Hi, this is Ike Evans of the Haug Foundation for Mental Health, and you are listening to Into the Fold. As a foundation, we believe that we are most effective in transforming mental health when we focus on historically excluded or marginalized populations. On numerous occasions, past and present, we have made the connection between mental health and well-being on the one hand, and a more just and equitable world on the other. This is one reason we are proud to observe International Holocaust Remembrance Day, which takes place every year on January 27th. It commemorates the tragedy of the Holocaust that occurred during the Second World War, the genocide that resulted in the deaths of 6 million Jews and 11 million others by the Nazi regime and its collaborators. The day was designated by a United Nations General Assembly resolution in November 2005. The day January 27th was chosen because it was the day in 1945 that the infamous Auschwitz death camp was liberated by the Soviet Red Army. All told, an estimated 1.1 million Jewish adults and children and over 200,000 Poles, Roma, Soviet POWs, homosexuals, and others were exterminated at Auschwitz between 1940 and 1945. This year's observance marks the 75th anniversary of that historic event. In recognition of International Holocaust Remembrance Day 2020, we're reaching deep into our archives to share a conversation between two pioneers, eminent historian Dr. Raoul Hilberg and the late Bert Krueger Smith. Bert Krueger Smith, who worked for the Haug Foundation from 1952 until she retired in 1983, left an indelible mark as one of the most influential employees in the Foundation's history as a program officer, writer, speaker, and radio host. Dr. Raoul Hilberg was an Austrian-born Jewish-American political scientist and historian. He was widely considered to be the world's preeminent scholar of the Holocaust, and his three-volume, more than 1,200-page work, The Destruction of the European Jews, is regarded as a seminal study of the Nazi Final Solution. What you are about to hear is from a late 1970s episode of The Human Condition, a radio series produced by the Haug Foundation that ran from 1971 to 1983 on KUT, hosted by Bert Krueger Smith. In conversation with Bert Krueger Smith, Dr. Raoul Hilberg, who passed away in 2007 at the age of 81, shares his reflections about the Holocaust, the conditions that led to it, and its cataclysmic impact on the Jewish population of Europe. In addition to listening to this interview and absorbing the rich dialogue, I strongly encourage you to learn as much as you can about Dr. Hilberg, to refresh your knowledge of the Holocaust, and to find out about any observances of International Holocaust Remembrance Day that may be happening in your area. And now, the interview.
From Communications Center, the University of Texas at Austin, this is another program in the series, The Human Condition.
There was a real problem in the course of a war. Does one eliminate skilled labor, which, as one well knows, is the scarcest commodity of all? And there was a conflict between the prosecution of the war and the final solution of the Jewish question, as it was called, and was finally resolved in favor of killing.
Produced in association with the Haug Foundation for Mental Health at UT Austin, these programs are about people and mental health as a part of every human experience. Here is your producer and host, Bert Krueger Smith.
guest this week on The Human Condition is Dr. Raoul Hilberg, professor of political science at the University of Vermont. Dr. Hilberg, you have written extensively and lectured all over the country in the area of the Holocaust. Why do you? What ends are served by reviewing such terrible happenings?
I am simply dedicated, in accordance with an old-established liberal arts principle, to discovery of facts and their dissemination to the extent that people are ready to receive them. They have not always been ready. This is a time when there is unusual heavy demand for information about this particular cataclysm.
When you are talking about the Holocaust, you are discussing Germany, World War II, correct?
That's right. It's the destruction of the European Jews in particular, beginning in 1933 and coming to a conclusion with the end of the war in 1945.
That was a long time ago, and let me ask you, Dr. Hilberg, do we have new facts? You said the dissemination of facts. Haven't these been reviewed and examined and discovered over the years?
I myself began the research about 30 years ago, and the broad outlines of what happened were known immediately after the event, most particularly when camps were being overrun by Allied forces. But the story of how these events transpired, the recapitulation of what went on in the minds of people who made the decisions in Germany, awaits a great deal of scholarship still, despite the fact that we obviously have filled many, many pages with documentary information. There is always more to be learned. It's such an extreme event that one can't simply leave it with an outline.
We are talking about what in terms of numbers?
My estimate of the number of dead Jews attributable to German action is slightly over 5 million.
And what did go on in the minds of some of the people who perpetuated these crimes? Some people, I suppose, were followers of orders, but we're talking about the people who made this cataclysm happen. How did it come about?
In actual fact, it was a process that did not follow a basic plan. There was no blueprint. And whereas one can discover a series of orders, often enough, they were curiously vague and sometimes only oral, not written. Moreover, I think it is clear that the entire machinery of destruction was drawn from every segment of German life, so that when we speak of perpetrators, we have to include diplomats or civil servants in various categories. We are dealing with accountants or engineers, physicians, specialized people, because the process itself was a highly technocratic and bureaucratic one. Thus, to ask what was in the minds of some of these people is to ask indeed a very large question. Well, we're asking it of a rather diversified group.
Let me phrase it another way then. Are we talking about an enormous master plan in which these people at all levels got together and made their blueprint for destruction? Or were there ways in which this just grew?
I think it was more growth than it was master plan. It was a step-by-step process, and those who were perpetrating it very rarely could see more than one step ahead. They came to each bridge and crossed it. And at some point, of course, they were crossing into virtually new territory, into unprecedented territory, something that had never happened before was now being attempted.
What was the purpose? Why would a nation go out to destroy one particular segment in such massive manner?
One clue I can give you, and it is the only one really, is that there are at least some indications that whereas the Jewish people were the very first, quite obviously, to be completely annihilated wherever the Germans could accomplish that task, there were some thoughts and even experiments and beginnings to include in this destruction process yet other people. For example, Gypsies. Yet others who were candidates for this sort of thing were Slavic peoples generally. Not all Slavic peoples, but perhaps Poles and Russians. They were not yet being annihilated, but there was some conversation about rooting out large numbers of them or finding means such as sterilization to prevent another generation of Slavs from inhabiting the earth. There is thus some indication that the Germans who were killing the Jews were thinking in larger terms of population policy on a much wider scale.
The people who did the planning were very rarely the ones who had to face the victims.
Oh, absolutely. As a matter of fact, they were desk people in the main. If you consider the business of writing decrees or scheduling trains or drawing up plans for a camp or requisitioning materials and things of this kind or processing confiscated property, all this was done by bureaucrats who very, very rarely saw the victim face to face. Now, there was one segment, of course, of that bureaucracy that was up against the victim directly. That was the police, SS. And there we do see repercussions. We do see something called psychic problems emerging, particularly when day after day there was shooting of men, women, and children. There was a certain rebellion in the ranks of those killers when they felt that they were being singled out for this, what they called, dirty work. They did not regard themselves as sadists, and they did not consider themselves as aberrants or deviants in any sense of the word. And it is for that reason that killing itself had to become a more remote process, and it is for that very purpose that gas chambers were being constructed capable of killing as many as 1,000 people at a time. That could be a little bit more impersonal than face-to-face shooting.
Preceding the gas chambers, there were other methods, and you're saying that the gas chambers came about for efficiency and for impersonality.
That's right.
What about the people who were the German citizens? We have heard that when the Holocaust film was shown on television, that many things happened to people who were citizens of Germany, many of them children who were not born when the Holocaust took place. What does happen to people, say people of goodwill, ordinary people, who find out that this is going on? I'm talking about the people who were living in Germany at that time. What happened to them psychologically?
Well, my feeling is that there was a certain amount of knowledge, obviously. Word came back from the occupied territories in the east of open-air shootings. Soldiers were occasionally photographing these events, writing home about them. There was a concerted effort at censorship, which didn't succeed. In addition, people were aware of their neighbors disappearing overnight, and never again were these people heard from. They obviously had questions in their minds. On top of all that, apartments vacated by Jews were being sealed. The contents, particularly furniture, was redistributed, most especially in 1943 and 1944, to bombed out people. So there were a variety of ways in which ordinary folk became aware of something. My feeling is that awareness or knowledge can be extremely partial, and there are mechanisms by which people attempt not to face the implications of certain kinds of knowledge. And in this particular situation, there was such an attempt at what might be called repression, some withdrawal of sorts from direct contemplation and talk about what was only dimly perceived at the time, but nevertheless indicative of very drastic activity.
I think we had just a sample of that during the Vietnam War when stories came back, and I think we in the United States had a very hard time reconciling our feeling of ourselves as a humanitarian democracy with some of the things that we heard were taking place. And I suppose there's always this kind of bridge that people who perceive themselves as good have to make in such a situation.
Well, I think there are two issues. One is that whenever you have a somewhat bloody operation in the most literal sense, many people not participating and not confronting such activities are shocked when, for the first time, they do see or are acutely confronted by these things. Vietnam was the first televised war, so that had its impact on the American people. But whereas a war or an operating room, for that matter, is for the layperson, the non-professional person, a shocking experience for the first time, we have to distinguish between what is sometimes ancillary or even essential in war, if you're going to fight any kind of a war, and something as deliberate as the destruction of a group of people, including the women and the small children, who were manifestly innocent, where there could be no rationalization that these were criminals or parasites or world conquerors or whatever, even though all of these rationalizations and justifications were being attempted. People are not stupid. They do not swallow idiotic propaganda. And therefore, they had quite another problem, perhaps a problem somewhat equivalent to an American who on television sees a little child suffering in war and then asks the question, did we have something to do with it, directly or indirectly, even though he realizes that inevitably there is going to be some of that suffering if a war is being fought at all. But it is one thing for this to have happened as a consequence of an inevitable widening of destruction in the course of warfare, and something that's deliberately widened, as the Germans widened their activities to include civilians, and particularly Jews, in lethal operations involving gas chambers. And that's the other side of it, you see.
You were saying something, Dr. Hilberg, about the feelings of the police who had to face their victims and kill. We noticed when we had a sniper at the University of Texas Tower who was killing very many people just at random, what happened was that anybody who was even a close observer who was part of it and who escaped had some kinds of psychological disquiet, and many people felt guilty that that they were alive when the other ones had died. Mm-hmm. You were talking about the psychic problems of the police. How do you know that they had this?
Well, we know of these problems of police because they were being discussed in correspondence, and there was rather extensive discussion in writing about means to alleviate psychic burdens. There were speeches being made, not open public speeches, but internal ones. So it was recognized as a problem. You would now call it a mental health problem. They didn't have that vocabulary. They talked about the soul being burdened, but it was more or less the same thing. And And thus they kept insisting and repeating to themselves, we are decent, we are decent, we must do this. There was even a principle, Himmler himself, chief of the SS and police, laid down, that Germans were not supposed to enjoy that sort of thing. They were not supposed to be sadists. They were supposed to do this for the good of their people, you see. That was the twist in the whole operation. In other words, to have... All of you know, he said at one time to assembled generals, what it means when 50 bodies lie there, or 500, or 5,000. To have come through all this and to have remained decent, that is a page of glory, he said, in our history. That was his attitude.
We can't live with the idea that we are evil. And I suppose even in criminals, we find that there is always a justification somehow.
Yes, there is an amazing amount of justifying. I can give you one small example, which is almost unbelievable. I've not seen it anywhere in print, and I must admit I haven't myself put it into print. But there was an incredible situation of someone, we do not really know who, probably a Ukrainian, who was a witness to a shooting of men, women, and children by some detachment of German forces. He was really not able to identify it. He reported his observation, which was received in Switzerland during the war, so it's a contemporaneous account. He came incredibly close to the scene so that he was within hearing distance of a person, an SS man, presumably an officer, who was addressing the victims. Now here we have a situation where they are within minutes of their death, and he's explaining to the victims that they had to die because they were responsible for the war. They were responsible for everything that was transpiring in this world. So now the logic seemed to indicate that they would have to pay with their lives for World War II. Now, this was said by some ordinary lieutenant or whoever to a group of very ordinary people drawn from a very ordinary population in a very ordinary part of the Soviet Union. And there it was, an incredible attempt by a perpetrator who is explaining something to people who within minutes are going to be dead.
He had to do it for himself.
Well, of course, of course.
Dr. Hilberg, why the Jews? What was to be gained by doing this annihilation? What went on in the minds of the people who planned this?
Well, of course, Germany was a very homogeneous country and had very few minorities. It wasn't pluralistic. It wasn't like the United States ever. The number of Jews in Germany in 1933 was 500,000, that is all. And ironically, a highly patriotic element in society, if one may call it that, and participated heavily in World War I, and had had its losses. There were, out of that relatively small population, 12,000 Jewish battle dead in the First World War, which gives you some indication. But there is, historically, a tradition of persecuting Jews. Now, I personally believe that bureaucrats are not highly original people in the sense that they actually try to avoid being original. And unlike a scientist or an engineer who may be very proud of having discovered something new, the bureaucrat inevitably disclaims such discovery even when he is responsible for it, and he tends to repeat precedent as much as possible. There was a body of precedent upon which to draw from the Middle Ages on. There were laws, canon laws even, going back to the Middle Ages, prohibition of intermarriages, or the Jewish star being implemented, or ghettoization measures of various kinds, which could be enacted without adding all that much that would be new to human experience. This was, in short, in some sense, a standby victim. It was readily at hand, although it had to be defined in a new way. And For that matter, therefore, I would say for the first 5 or 6 years during the exploitative stage, during the time when Jewish property was being acquired and when large companies in Germany took advantage of the persecution of the Jews to acquire smaller companies and thereby assure to themselves an even larger share of production or market. There are some rather rational, cold-blooded considerations in this. Yet later on, when the Jews had no longer very much left, not much could be taken away from them anymore, and when the most valuable commodity that could have been exploited by the Germans in the Jewish population was sheer labor, especially skilled labor, which in Eastern Europe was a very substantial portion of all skilled labor, because in Eastern Europe it was the Jews who were the carpenters and the locksmiths and the furriers and all these people that were producing, you know, shoes and whatnot. So there was a real problem in the course of a war. Does one eliminate skilled labor, which, as one well knows, is the scarcest commodity of all? And there was a conflict between the prosecution of the war and the final solution of the Jewish question, as it was called, and was finally resolved in favor of killing. In the bureaucratic language of the time, considerations of the war effort were not to be invoked to, in any sense, diminish the scope of the final solution.
In a very minute way, Dr. Hilberg, isn't the choice of the Jews as victims part of man's innate suspicion of differences and of people who are unlike? You were saying that they were visible by their unlikeness in the German population. And do you think that might have been one reason why they were selected?
Well, yes and no. There was a certain amount of difference, but it was not a mysterious difference. There wasn't really anything mysterious about the Jewish population. You have to remember that Jews were settled in Germany, when we talk about the Rhine River, perhaps even earlier than Germans themselves. So we're dealing with a situation of not uninterrupted, but rather long residency on the part of Jewish people extending for a period of perhaps 1,300 years.
Could I ask you to sum up for us? I want to get a final question, and that is, how can we, ordinary people who think we are people of goodwill, how can we keep such terrible acts from happening in our times? What are steps that we can take?
Well, I have to be very fundamental about it, and I have to say that you can't be good in one sector. And as the Germans attempted, they were trying to be good fathers and good family men while they were killing Jews. This is ultimately not possible. One has to be humanistic in a total sense of the word, and that's really the only way in which anything as drastic as this can be prevented. There's no shortcut.
Thank you very much, Dr. Hilberg. We've been talking this week on the human condition with Dr. Raoul Hilberg, professor of political science at the University of Vermont.
That was Bert Krueger Smith with another conversation about the human condition and mental health as a part of every human experience. This program was produced by KUT-FM and distributed by Communications Center, the University of Texas at Austin, in association with the Hogg Foundation. This is the Longhorn Radio Network.
This is our second visit to the Human Condition Archive for the podcast. Last February, we resurfaced a conversation between Bert Krueger Smith and Dr. Kenneth Clark, a renowned African-American psychologist who, in tandem with his wife Mamie Phipps Clark, conducted pioneering research on the effects of discrimination on children's attitudes about race. Their work played an influential role in the legal struggles against segregation in the 1950s. They testified as expert witnesses in Briggs versus Elliott, one of the cases rolled into the historic Brown versus Board of Education case of 1954. This 1974 episode of The Human Condition, once again hosted by Bert Krueger Smith, is a rare opportunity to hear Dr. Kenneth Clark, who passed away in 2005 at the age of 90, in his own words. It's also an outstanding example of an earnest dialogue about the relationship between mental health and the everyday conditions in which people live, learn, work, play, and pray, a focus that is still at the center of the Hogg Foundation's work.
One more thing, Dr. Clark. Some Greek philosopher has said, when those who have not been injured become as indignant as those who have, we're moving toward a sense of justice.
That is, to me, a very important, very profound and true statement, that we will have stability, moral stability, and justice in a society when those who are not the immediate victims of injustice feel as intensely the injustice as the victim himself.
These dialogues are just a couple examples of the rich audio history captured in conversation for the Human Condition radio show. During its near 400-episode run, the show explored mental health, philosophy, sociology, and other aspects of what it means to be human, and featured such notables as Dr. T. Barry Brazelton, the celebrated pediatrician, Oscar-winning actress Mercedes McCambridge, and Raoul Hilberg, among others. A sample of the show archive can be found on iTunes and Apple Podcasts. You'll find a link in the episode description. Thanks for joining us.